Hey, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Narration by George podcast, the podcast on audiobooks, spiritual ideas, and other items of interest. This is podcast number 61, and I'm George Taylor. Last week, we started looking at the first of the Sherlock Holmes stories, a short novel entitled A Study in Scarlet. This week, we will continue that look by focusing on the second section of the novel. And at the end of the show, I have a couple of interesting This Week in History tidbits that pertain to books and reading. In the first section of A Study in Scarlet, we watched as Holmes surveys a crime scene and makes some deduction. He then goes about the business of catching the killer in 3 days, while London police detectives Gregson and Lestrade are running all around in the wrong directions. What we don't know is the why behind the murders which have been committed. That is what we learn about in section 2 of this novel, that section entitled The Country of the Saints. This section opens with an amazing description of a desert in the central portion of the great North American continent. Take a listen. In the central portion of the great North American continent, there lies an arid and repulsive desert, which for many a long year served as a barrier against the advance of civilization. From the Sierra Nevada to Nebraska, from the Yellowstone River in the north to the Colorado up on the south, is a region of desolation and silence. Nor is nature always in one mood throughout this grim district. It comprises snow-capped and lofty mountains and dark and gloomy valleys. There are swift-flowing rivers which dash through jagged canyons, and there are enormous plains which in winter are white with snow and in summer are gray with the saline alkali dust. They all preserve, however, the common characteristics of barrenness, inhospitality, and misery. There are no inhabitants in this land of despair. A band of Pawnees or of Blackfeet may occasionally traverse it in order to reach other hunting grounds, but the heartiest of the braves are glad to lose sight of those awesome plains and to find themselves once more upon their prairies. The coyote skulks along the scrub, the buzzard flaps heavily through the air, and the clumsy grizzly bear lumbers through the dark ravines and picks up such sustenance as it can among the rocks. These are the sole dwellers in the wilderness. In the whole world there could be no more dreary view than that from the northern slope of the Sierra Blanco. As far as the eye can reach stretches the great flat plain land, all dusted over with patches of alkali and intersected by clumps of the dwarfish chaparral bushes. On the extreme verge of the horizon lie a long chain of mountain peaks with their rugged summits flecked with snow. In this great stretch of country there is no sign of life, nor of anything appertaining to life. There is no bird in the steel-blue heaven, no movement upon the dull gray earth. Above all, there is absolute silence. Listen as one may, there is no shadow of a sound in all that mighty wilderness, nothing but silence, complete and heart-subduing silence. It has been said that there is nothing appertaining to life upon the broad plain. That is hardly true. Looking down from the Sierra Blanco, one sees a pathway traced out across the desert, which winds away and is lost in the extreme distance. It is rutted with wheels and trodden down by the feet of many adventurers. Here and there are scattered white objects which glisten in the sun and stand out against the dull deposit of alkali. Approach and examine them. They are bones, some large and coarse, others small and more delicate. The former have belonged to oxen and the latter to men. For 1,500 miles one may trace this ghastly caravan route by these scattered remains of those who had fallen by the wayside. Looking down on this very scene, there stood upon the 4th of May, 1847, a solitary traveler. His appearance was such that he might have been the very genius or demon of the region. An observer would have found it difficult to say whether he was nearer 40 or to 60. His face was lean and haggard, and the brown parchment-like skin was drawn tightly over the projecting bones. His long brown hair and beard were all flecked and dashed with white. His eyes were sunken in his head and burned with an unnatural luster, while the hand which grasped his rifle was hardly more fleshly than that of a skeleton. As he stood, he leaned upon his weapon for support, and yet his tall figure and the massive framework of his bones suggested a wiry and vigorous constitution. His gaunt face, however, and his clothes, which hung so baggily over his shriveled limbs, proclaimed what it was that gave him that senile and decrepit appearance. The man was dying from hunger and from thirst. Doyle was certainly a fine writer. In that setting, this story takes off. The man we met, John Ferrier, is traveling with a little girl, Lucy. He is rescued by a caravan of Mormons headed for Utah. Ferrier makes its home with them in Utah and raises Lucy into adulthood. It was a warm June morning, and the Latter-day Saints were as busy as the bees whose hive they have chosen for their emblem. In the fields and in the streets rose the same hum of human industry. Down the dusty high roads defiled long streams of heavily laden mules, all heading to the west, for the gold fever had broken out in California, and the overland route lay through the city of the elect. There, too, were droves of sheep and bullocks coming in from the outlying pasture lands and trains of tired immigrants, men and horses equally weary of their interminable journey. Through all this motley assemblage, threading her way with the skill of an accomplished rider, there galloped Lucy Ferrier, her fair face flushed with the exercise and her long chestnut hair floating out behind her. She had a commission from her father in the city, and was dashing in, as she had done many a time before, with all the fearlessness of youth, thinking only of her task and how it was to be performed. The travel-stained adventurers gazed at her in astonishment, and even the unemotional Indians, journeying in with their pelties, relaxed their accustomed stoicism as they marveled at the beauty of the pale-faced maiden. She had reached the outskirts of the city when she found the road blocked by a great drove of cattle, driven by a half-dozen wild-looking herdsmen from the plains. In her impatience, she endeavored to pass this obstacle by pushing her horse into what appeared to be a gap. Scarcely had she got fairly into it, however, before the beast closed in behind her, and she found herself completely embedded in the moving stream of fierce-eyed, long-horned bullocks. Accustomed as she was to deal with cattle, she was not alarmed at her situation, but took advantage of every opportunity to urge her horse on in the hopes of pushing her way through the cavalcade. Unfortunately, the horns of one of the creatures, either by accident or design, came in violent contact with the flank of the mustang and excited it to madness. In an instant it reared up on its hind legs with a snort of rage and pranced and tossed in a way that would have unseated any but the most skillful rider. The situation was full of peril. Every plunge of the excited horse brought it against the horns again and goaded it into fresh madness. It was all that the girl could do to keep herself in the saddle. Yet a slip would mean a terrible death under the hooves of the unwieldy and terrified animals. Unaccustomed to such emergencies, her head began to swim, and her grip upon the bridle to relax. Choked by the rising cloud of dust and by the steam from the struggling creatures, she might have abandoned her efforts in despair, but for a kindly voice at her elbow which assured her of assistance. At the same moment, a sinewy brown hand caught the frightened horse by the curb, and forcing a way through the drove, soon brought her to the outskirts. "You're not hurt, I hope, miss," said her preserver, respectfully. She looked up at his dark, fierce face and laughed saucily. "I'm awful frightened," she said naively. "Whoever would have thought that Pancho would have been so scared by a lot of cows?"
"Thank God you kept your seat," said the other earnestly.
He was a tall, savage-looking young fellow, mounted on a powerful roan horse and clad in the rough dress of a hunter, with a long rifle slung over his shoulders.
"I guess you are the daughter of John Ferrier," he remarked. "I saw you ride down from his house. When you see him, ask him if he remembers the Jefferson Hopes of St. Louis. If he's the same Ferrier, my father and he were pretty thick."
"Hadn't you better come and ask yourself?" she asked demurely. The young fellow seemed pleased at the suggestion, and his dark eyes sparkled with pleasure.
"I will do so," he said. "We've been in the mountains for 2 months, and are not over and above in the visiting condition. He must take us as he finds us."
"He has a good deal to thank you for, and so have I," she answered. "He's awful fond of me. If those cows had jumped on me, he'd have never gotten over it."
"Neither would I," said her companion.
"You? Well, I don't see that it would make much matter to you anyhow. You ain't even a friend of ours."
The young hunter's dark face grew so gloomy over this remark that Lucy Ferrier laughed aloud.
"There, I didn't mean that," she said. "Of course, you are a friend now. You must come and see us. Now, I must push along, or Father won't trust me with his business any more. Goodbye."
"Goodbye," he answered, raising his broad sombrero and bending over her little hand.
She wheeled her mustang round and gave it a cut with her riding whip and darted away down the broad road in a rolling cloud of dust.
Lucy and Jefferson court and are engaged to marry. However, that doesn't set well with the Mormon leaders in John Ferrier's community. They've taken him in, they say, with the provision that he follow their ways. Among them is to have Lucy marry within the Mormon community. This Ferrier is not willing to do. So, with the help of Hope, the three of them leave everything behind and attempt an escape from Utah. They make that escape into an area they believe is safe. Hope ventures off to find food for them and then returns to an unfortunate find.
When he turned the corner, he came full in sight of the spot where the fire had been. There was still a glowing pile of wood ashes there, but it had evidently not been tended since his departure. The same dead silence still reigned all around. With his fears all changed to convictions, he hurried on. There was no living creature near the remains of the fire. Animals, man, maiden, all were gone. It was only too clear that some sudden and terrible disaster had occurred during his absence, a disaster which embraced them all, and yet had left no traces behind it. Bewildered and stunned by this blow, Jefferson Hope felt his head spin round, and he had to lean upon his rifle to save himself from falling. He was essentially a man of action, however, and speedily recovered from his temporary impotence. Seizing a half-consumed piece of wood from the smoldering fire, he blew it into a flame and proceeded with its help to examine the little camp.
The ground was all stamped down by the feet of horses, showing that a large party of mounted men had overtaken the fugitives, and the direction of their tracks proved that they had afterwards turned back to Salt Lake City. Had they carried back both of his companions with them? Jefferson Hope had almost persuaded himself that they must have done so, when his eye fell upon an object which made every nerve of his body tingle within him. A little way on one side of the camp was a low-lying heap of reddish soil, which had assuredly not been there before. There was no mistaking it for anything but a newly dug grave. As the young hunter approached it, he perceived that a stick had been planted on it with a sheet of paper stuck in the cleft fork of it. The inscription upon the paper was brief, but to the point. John Ferrier, formerly of Salt Lake City, died August 4th, 1860. The sturdy old man, whom he had left so short a time before, was gone then, and this was all his epitaph. Jefferson Hope looked wildly around to see if there was a second grave, but there was no sign of one. Lucy had been carried back by their terrible pursuers to fulfill her original destiny by becoming one of the harem of the elder's son. As the young fellow realized the certainty of her fate and his own powerlessness to prevent it, he wished that he, too, was lying with the old farmer in his last silent resting place. Again, however, his active spirit shook off the lethargy which springs from despair. If there was nothing else left to him, he could at least devote his life to revenge. With indomitable patience and perseverance, Jefferson Hope possessed also a power of sustained vindictiveness, which he may have learned from the Indians amongst whom he had lived. As he stood by the desolate fire, he felt that the only one thing which would assuage his grief would be thorough and complete retribution brought by his own hand upon his enemies. His strong will and untiring energy should, he determined, be devoted to that one end. With a grim white face, he retraced his steps to where he had dropped the food, and having stirred up the smoldering fire, he cooked enough to last him for a few days. This he made up into a bundle, and tired as he was, he set himself to walk back through the mountains upon the track of the avenging angels. So now we know the why of the murders. Revenge. The rest of the book shifts back to a London setting. Jefferson Hope tells his story from start to finish, and then Holmes explains to Watson how he came to the conclusions he did about the case. We had all been warned to appear before the magistrates upon the Thursday, but when the Thursday came, there was no occasion for our testimony. A higher judge had taken the matter in hand, and Jefferson Hope had been summoned before a tribunal where strict justice would be meted out to him. On the very night after his capture, the aneurysm burst, and he was found in the morning stretched upon the floor of the cell with a placid smile upon his face, as though he had been able in his dying moments to look back upon a useful life and on work well done. "Gregson and Lestrade will be wild about his death," Holmes remarked as we chatted it over the next morning. "Where will their grand advertisement be now?" "I don't see that they had very much to do with his capture," I answered. "What you do in this world is a matter of no consequence," returned my companion bitterly. "The question is, what can you make people believe that you have done?" "Never mind," he continued more brightly after a pause. "I would not have missed the investigation for anything. There has been no better case within my recollection. Simple as it was, there were several most instructive points about it." "Simple!" I ejaculated. "Well, really, it can hardly be described as otherwise,"
said Sherlock Holmes, smiling at my surprise.
"The proof of its intrinsic simplicity is that without any help, save a very few ordinary deductions, I was able to lay my hand upon the criminal within 3 days."
"That is true," said I.
"I have already explained to you that what is out of the common is usually a guide rather than a hindrance. In solving a problem of this sort, the grand thing is to be able to reason backwards. That is a very useful accomplishment, and a very easy one. But people do not practice it much. In the everyday affairs of life, it is more useful to reason forwards, and so the other comes to be neglected. There are 50 who can reason synthetically for one who can reason analytically."
"I confess," said I, "that I do not quite follow you."
"I hardly expected that you would. Let me see if I can make it clearer. Most people, if you describe a train of events to them, will tell you what the result would be. They can put those events together in their minds and argue from them that something will come to pass. There are few people, however, who, if you told them a result, would be able to evolve from their own inner consciousness what the steps were which led up to that result. This power is what I mean when I talk of reasoning backwards or analytically."
"I understand," said I.
"Now, this was a case in which you were given the result and had to find everything else for yourself. Now let me endeavor to show you the different steps in my reasoning. To begin, at the beginning, I approached the house, as you know, on foot, and with my mind entirely free of all impressions. I naturally began by examining the roadway, and there, as I have already explained to you, I clearly saw the marks of a cab, which I ascertained by inquiry must have been there during the night. I satisfied myself that it was a cab, and not a private carriage, by the narrow gauge of the wheels. The ordinary London growler is considerably less wide than a gentleman's brougham. This was the first point gained. I then walked slowly down the garden path, which happened to be composed of a clay soil peculiarly suitable for taking impressions. No doubt it appeared to you to be a mere trampled line of slush, but to my trained eyes every mark upon its surface had a meaning. There is no branch of detective science which is so important and so much neglected as the art of tracing footsteps. Happily, I've always laid a great stress upon it, and much practice has made it second nature to me.
I saw we'll fade out Sherlock's explanation so as not to spoil the book for you. As the book closes, Holmes finds that the papers gave credit to Gregson and Lestrade, and not to him. He is merely an amateur who has shown some talent in the detective line. I invite you to check out this short novel. You'll find a special introductory price for the purchase of the novel at my website. That's narrationbygeorge.com/books. At the top of the page, you'll find the logo for the book. Click on it, and you'll see the link for the special price. So don't delay. There's less than a week left on this special. Production will begin shortly on the next Sherlock Holmes novel, The Sign of the Four. This story has a complex plot involving service in the East India Tea Company, India, the Indian Rebellion of 1857, a stolen treasure, and a secret pact among four convicts, the four of the title, and two corrupt prison guards. That's the next Sherlock Holmes novel. Now, I promised you a couple of This Week in History trivia bits about books and reading. Did you know that on this week in 1785, Benjamin Franklin wrote that he had just invented bifocal glasses? Don't know what I'd do without mine. And in 1911, the New York Public Library was dedicated. Now you know. That's our time for this week's Narration by George podcast, the podcast on audiobooks, spiritual ideas, and other items of interest. Join me next week for what I hope will be a new author interview. Remember, God has blessed you, share that blessing with someone else. See you next week.